Let me just point out that this is the first time I'm using this new AMBO, and the first time we're using the new Credence table. This is the first Mass since they've arrived, right? So very beautiful. These were made, this was made from the AMBO, right? Or from the altar?
From the altar.
All from the altar? All from the altar, and that's made from the altar that used to be here. So a beautiful reuse of the sacred furnishings, and not very nice. Well, maybe this isn't the right crowd to start this way, but I'll tell you what came to my mind when I was reading about St. Peter Claver. It's an example from the professional basketball world, the NBA. Like I say, maybe you're not, I don't know if anybody follows NBA, but the top scorer in professional basketball history, the top scorer in the world in history is LeBron James. And he's scored by far more points than anyone in history. I think he's over 40,000 points. And I read an article after he broke the record maybe last year or early this year, I can't remember. I mean, it was not too long ago. And after he broke the record, I read an article about what it takes to break a record like that and whether anyone will ever be able to break LeBron James' record, which he's still adding to. He's still an active player. Just won a gold medal just last in the Olympics. So, I mean, he's still actively playing at a very high level. And anyway, this article made the point that not only do you have to be a top scorer, you have to be a top scorer for a long, long time. So to be the best scorer in the league for 10 years, you would still not break his record. You have to be among the top scorers of the league for 20 years. So a combination of very high production and longevity. So it's a very hard record to break, and it's phenomenal. So that's why it's something to celebrate. What does that have to do with anything? It has to do with St. Peter Claver, the LeBron James of baptizing people. He, during his ministry, he baptized over 300,000 people. Now, I was teased about this. I like numbers, you know, and I was teased about doing some calculations about this, but I did it again last night when I looked at this 300,000 people. He was a priest for 38 years, but the last 4 years of his life, it says he suffered from a paralyzing illness. So I assume he wasn't doing baptisms. Maybe I'm wrong, but I knocked off 4 years. That's 34 years of active ministry. So if you divide 300,000 by 34, you get over 8,800 baptisms a year. And if you divide 8,800 plus by 365 days, you get 24 baptisms a day. Every day, 7 days a week for 34 years. Now, obviously, he didn't baptize every single day. And so that means some days he did a lot more than 24 baptisms in a day. I said, that's just mind-boggling to me. It's like LeBron James. I said, how can he do that? And it's one thing to baptize a lot of people in a year. But for 30 years, 34 years, to keep going and keep going. And as you know, he was... The focus of his ministry was the poorest of the poor, the people who were considered not even people, the slaves, the black slaves. So he's just a phenomenal person, and I think he deserves a little bit of recognition. So that's why I'm taking this moment to compare him to the greatest scorer of all time. Well, he's perhaps, I don't know any other saints who have done lots of baptisms, but it's just a phenomenal number. I'm not even sure that we have even personally met that many people. You know, and how many people meet 300,000 people in their lifetime? I don't know. And we see that many, maybe you go to a big crowds, but actually personal encounter, 8,000 people in a year? I don't think so, because we see the same people all the time. But to baptize, you have to say the person's name. So it means that it's at least the name, and I baptize you, and it says in the descriptions of his life, he catechized and served, fed, clothed, and he also spent some time blasting the slave owners and even members of the church who were promoting the slave trade. So he didn't only baptize, he did a lot of things. So just an extraordinary missionary whom God raised up at the time when the slave trade was starting to boom, meaning the kidnapping black Africans and bringing them to South America and to the Americas, which is a horrible, unspeakable crime against humanity, really. And imagine if there's 300,000 he baptized, how many slaves there were? Because he didn't baptize all of them. So there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of millions of people who were reduced to slavery. And many of them died before they even served as slaves. They died because of mistreatment. So that whole thing just, I think, is worth bringing out how God raises up holiness to address and overcome evil. It's like Maximilian Kolbe in the death camp. It's like that. I mean, that when there's horrible evil, God is also at work in his own ways. Okay, so that's St. Peter Claver. He was alive or served in the 17th century. So a time of great development of, you know, world expansion, but also expansion of evil. Okay, that's St. Peter Claver. Let's take a look at the readings today. The gospel is the story of Jesus healing a man with a withered hand. Now, I suppose if you did an analysis of Jesus' healings, you would see that most of the time he just heals people when he sees them or when they approach him. That's the usual thing. Yesterday, in yesterday's gospel, he healed the deaf man, and he did it in a particularly personal way. He pulled him away from the crowd all by himself, made these gestures, you know, he touched his ears, he spit, and all these things. And he uttered this word, Ephphatha, be opened. But it was just for that deaf man. And as I was reflecting on that yesterday, the source of our knowledge about that event has to be from the deaf man himself, because Jesus was alone with the man. And so the deaf man is the one who told the story. This is what he did. He made all these gestures. And then he said this word, very first word the man heard, Ephphatha. So that was an example of very personal, particular ministry, an example of how God treats each one of us as a unique individual, which I think is always an encouraging thing. We're all different. We all have different needs, and God knows them, and he addresses our personal situation. Now, in today's healing story, it's the other extreme. Jesus takes the opportunity to call a man with an illness, a withered hand, and make him stand up in front of everybody. Yesterday it was the most secret possible thing. This is the most public possible thing. Well, maybe the raising of Lazarus, probably more public and more dramatic, because take away the stone and everybody saw the guy come out of the tomb. So it's hard to compare. But this is a very a striking public miracle, healing miracle. And without gestures and special words, he just says, stretch out your hand, and he's healed. The power of Jesus' word. But it's, yes, for the man with the withered hand, because Jesus' ministry and God's love for us is very personal, individual, unique. But it's also a testimony. It's a public action to give instruction, especially to the scribes and Pharisees who are hard-hearted and who need something to break through their condition. And so he does it very publicly on the Sabbath after asking them the question, is it right to do good on the Sabbath? Which is obvious. There's an obvious answer. Well, yes, it's right to do good on the Sabbath. He does good on the Sabbath. It still doesn't work. They do evil on the Sabbath because they become enraged and they discuss together what they might do to him. So plotting evil is evil all the time, but especially on the Sabbath. So see, the contrast is set up. But my central point there is, though, God addresses the unique situation of each person, sometimes in secret, sometimes in public. Sometimes it's not for anyone else to know. In fact, sometimes we don't even know ourselves what God does for us. But sometimes in public, because he wants us to be examples of his love. Witnesses. The opposite of being an example of God's love is being an example of sin. And that's what we're addressing in today's first reading, Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. He brings up a scandalous case of a man living with his father's wife. So I guess that would be his stepmother. a man with his stepmother, who apparently are living in a some kind of pseudo marriage. Well, so that's an anti-witness. So a witness of God's love for us and our response to that love is beautiful and inspiring. A witness of sin is scandalous and disturbing. And as Paul says, even the pagans don't fall this low. Then Paul pronounces a very severe judgment on this man. And this might be worth reflecting on, because in our times, the only ones we're allowed to severely judge are the people who are violating the standard, public opinion. So if you don't, stand up for trans rights or something, then you're judged. But this immorality, Paul judges very severely in a way that we probably could hardly talk like this nowadays, because what he says is, I pronounce judgment on him, even though I'm not even there. I pronounce judgment on him, and I'm uniting myself with you to pronounce judgment on him. And he says, when you gather together, you are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, so that his spirit may be saved on the day of the Lord. Well, delivering someone over to Satan is about as bad as it gets. And it doesn't sound like Christian love to us. So what's going on here? We have to distinguish between falling into sin and remaining in a state of sin. If you use your imagination, it's not hard to imagine that some man might fall into a sin with his stepmother if his father married a beautiful young woman or something like that. I mean, it's weird, it's sick, it's disturbing, but it's not impossible to imagine that that might happen. But then you would say, that was wrong, and repent and ask the Lord's mercy, and if it was publicly known, ask forgiveness and, restore the disorder. Any sin can be forgiven. Every sin can be forgiven. Thanks be to God, because we're all sinners. But to remain in a state of sin is something else. This is not just an act of weakness or a foolishness or youthful indiscretion. This is a condition. It's a lasting state where they live together as man and wife, and everybody knows it, and they're not repenting. So what do you do with that? That's a different thing. Now, it maybe it's obvious, but that's a very different thing. That can't be tolerated. And that's what Paul is saying here. This condition has to be judged severely, exposed as wrong. Delivering him over to Satan is a way of saying, exposing that he's already in the grip of Satan. They are already in the grip of Satan because they're hardened in sin, in a state of sin. And notice what he says, deliver him over to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, meaning the destruction of his sinful behavior. That has to be destroyed because it's destroying him, so that his spirit may be saved on the day of the Lord. It's actually the most merciful thing he could come up with to save this guy. So it sounds shocking to us, but the more you ponder it, you realize Paul is really out to save this man who's in really severe condition. He's in a dangerous spiritual condition. Now, this has social and political implications. I know that in our times, it's become, I don't know if it's illegal, but it's at least difficult for Catholic institutions to address states of sin among their employees. You've probably heard of this. Teachers, for example, who in Catholic schools who marry their same-sex partner, or who are have a live-in relationship and therefore creating a scandal and violating principles of Christianity. And then the Catholic schools say, well, I'm sorry, if you either have to change your state of life or you can no longer teach in this school. And then the offenders go to the court and say, you're violating my contract. You can't fire me just because I live with my boyfriend or whatever it is. And then it becomes a legal battle. And so Why is this a matter? It's not that you find teachers who never sin. I mean, there's no teacher who doesn't ever sin. But it's the state of sin. It's the public witness of sin. It's the condition of sin that is, it can't be tolerated. And schools and dioceses and any Catholic institution is right to pass a judgment on that. Not because they're against anyone, but because that's the most merciful possible thing. And I'm just trying to put a modern application of the principle that Paul is teaching here. So don't let, without judgment of anybody, and like I say, we're all sinners, and no one has a right to say anybody's a better or worse sinner. But a state of sin is a different thing, and it has to be rejected. Then Paul, after making the statement about that particular case, that particular man in that low sin, worse than the pagans, then he goes on to this business about yeast. And this is more general. Don't let yourself be corrupted. He's not just talking about the man anymore. He's talking about the Christian community. Don't let a little bit of yeast ruin all the dough. We're supposed to be unleavened bread. And the reason why we can be unleavened bread is because Jesus Christ has been sacrificed. The Paschal Lamb has set us free from that kind of yeast. And so now we don't have to be corrupted by sin. So he says, let's be whom Christ has saved us to be, and let's not celebrate our feasts with the old yeast of malice and wickedness. I mean, not just talking about adultery with your mother or stepmother anymore. He's talking about all malice and wickedness, meaning that kind of condition hardened in sin. No, we are saved. We are sinners who are saved, and we have become the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So I think it's, when you ponder it a little bit, you see the wisdom of this, how God wants everyone to be free of sin, and we should want everyone to be free of sin. So we proclaim the mercy of God, and we also proclaim the destructive characteristic of being in a state of sin. Not that we have to walk up and down the streets telling people that they're in the hands of Satan, but if we can help someone out of that condition, yes, love obliges us to help them. That's what Paul is trying to do with the Christian community in Corinth. So whether it's a personal, private miracle that God is working for us, or whether it's a public condition of that God is using as a witness, we're participating in his work of restoring and proclaiming freedom from sin and the joy of being among the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.